So you can continue.
Yes, that created the best political conditions for both sides accepting a gradual process of negotiations. Once again, the FMLN was and the FDR were from the very beginning very reluctant and skeptical about a fair play, and I would say that Mexico and the Mexican president and the Mexican foreign minister and every one of us was always trying to convince them that that for them was there was no choice for neither side, that they better discuss in good faith and gave all the power to the UN to be, they say, the power broker, and in terms of the negotiating process. So I guess that sort of became convinced, and it was the FMLN initiative to have the other governments involved as kind of guarantee that they would not be trapped by, let's say, bureaucracies or by international agents that they couldn't really participate. So FMLN and FDR were the ones who discussed with the Secretary General to invite a number of countries, and from the outset they sort of they decided that Mexico, Spain, Colombia and Venezuela would be the best actors. Why these four countries? I would say that in the one hand with Mexico it was obvious because they had been based here. The fact that Mexico was also able to speak with the government, we had full diplomatic relations, we had an embassy there, we had investment there. Mexico is a relevant country in El Salvador. Obviously we had kind of a different approach and different points of view with the Salvadorian government, but at the end of the day they recognized that Mexico was there in good faith.
Yeah.
The Salvadorian government really resent that every year, twice a year, Mexico was, as I mentioned before, the leading force on the human rights resolution, and they were very upset about it. But for us that was the only way. So to keep an eye, we had a special rapporteur appointed there, was in Spain, very intelligent man, who had to present every 6 months a report on the human rights situation in El Salvador. So Mexico was an obvious choice from both sides. And then Spain, for being a country out of the region, a country that has historical links with the region.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that Felipe González was a man from a social democrat that was had the credibility of the FMLN. El Salvador government found that Carlos Andrés Pérez in Venezuela also had the necessary credentials to be also a good supporter of the process, and Mr. Barco, and later he was replaced by Gaviria, but it was Barco, Virgilio Barco in Colombia, who sort of the four presidents. And I think it's important to recognize, because as I mentioned to you before, we resent very much the fact that in his memoirs Mr. Pérez de Cuellar didn't include the name of the four presidents and the fact that they were actively engaged, mainly the president of Mexico and the president of Spain.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that we pay a tab for that support, because sometimes our activities were not exactly well seen inside our countries, and were not well seen either by some groups in the United States. And however, we stick to the idea that Mexico and the other three friends had to play a role. So I guess that we were not only supportive in New York, but we were supportive in our capitals and also in Washington.
What was the involvement of the U.S., the USSR, and Cuba in relationship to the group of friends, or were there different levels?
Well, in fact, I have to say that we never consider the USSR and the in Cuba as part of our process. However, we consider always the we used to say either the fifth friend or the four plus one,
mm-hmm.
and we kept always well informed, closely informed the U.S. mission in New York,
okay.
and also our embassies in Washington and our capitals about what we were doing. In fact, I have to say that the peace process in El Salvador was the result of the not only the activities of the Secretary General in his aides, but also and mainly it was possible because of the political support of the four plus one. And the four plus one was so important because the plus one, the one, was the most important in terms of being the one and only country who had the leverage with the El Salvador government,
mm-hmm.
the real leverage with the military, and at certain points that the negotiations were stuck. It was the one, not the four friends, but the one who were approached by the four friends saying, you know, there is nothing to do with this particular negotiation unless you send somebody to the El Salvador. And sometimes you had even people such a stature like Colin Powell traveling to El Salvador for 2 or 3 hours, talking to the military there and back into the United States, and then the four friends were able to sort of move ahead. I think that this is important.
At what conjuncture did Colin Powell, what were the issues that in this case sent him there, and then we can talk about others?
I would say that Powell and others, you know, were very actively engaged. I mean, even at one point moving into a trip to El Salvador. Obviously, it was this guy in a different way, but talking to the military there, and when the negotiations between FMLN, FDR, and the UN on the peace agreement were stuck, you know, and mainly about what kind of let's say guarantees that the former members of the FMLN will have in the peace process, the national police, issues that were very closely linked to national security issues, not about agrarian reform, but about mm-hmm. what are we going to do with the weapons afterwards?
Mm-hmm.
What are we going to have an amnesty afterwards or not?
Mm-hmm.
When you will find the military in El Salvador on very sort of very reluctant positions to accept political solutions, you know. After all, for them, the guerrillas were killers, were assassins, you know,
mm-hmm.
and were illegals, were unlawfuls, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they used this type of language, and sometimes their negotiators were not prepared to accept absolutely anything. That's exactly when the plus one played a very important role, because none of our countries, President Salinas, for instance, was in close contact with Alfredo Cristiani, but we were certainly clear that we didn't have the leverage, the necessary leverage to move and remove obstacles. We had leverage with the FMLN, we had leverage with the FDR, but we don't have that clout with the government, and none of the four friends. I would say that none of the four friends had a clout with you. So we had to, that's what, when we use the good offices of the US government. I would say that's, when you talk about the four friends, it's always important to stress the fact that we always consider the four plus one. We, and very often that we have meetings, we invite, we separate the meetings of the four friends, and we used to say, well, now we need a meeting of the four plus one. And the four plus one was mainly in our mission. The Mexican mission was not because it was the best located, it's around the corner from the US mission, but because my government and my president were the ones who were more actively engaged personally. I think that that's very important to stress.
Yeah.
This has nothing to do with who was more protagonic. The fact that the FMLN, FDR had their base in Mexico, had confidence in historical confidence in Mexican authorities, gave us not a distinction, because in a way it was not a distinction, it was very expensive to have the meetings here in Mexico. We paid for a number of these meetings in 1990, 1991.
Right.
If I'm not wrong, I think Alvaro Soto has a better account than I have, but I think the first year the UN group, the UN team, it was extremely well conducted by Alvaro de Soto, although that create tensions with other friends and so on and so forth, because Alvaro was considered some days like that he was leaning on the side of the FMLN or other side, or the FMLN was saying that Alvaro was giving everything to the government. This is normal in any negotiating process, but I was going to say that the first year, 1990, when they start discussing, mm-hmm. I guess they spent almost like 180 something days in Mexico, and the next day they spent well over 250 days in Mexico. I think Alvaro was mostly living here, and it was difficult for Mexico.
Who paid for all of that?
Well, the UN used to play a part, and we used to play, Mexican government play a lot of this. Let's say retreats that they had to have in different parts of Mexico. Sometimes we have to deal with the fact that one member or another, not from the UN team, but from the FMLN or from the government, were not very pleased with this hotel, with all hotel, with these kind of things. That it now sounds like anecdote, but at that time it was very annoying that you were paying. You were putting everything together, and some of them were not very pleased with the food, for instance, you know.
So Mexico paid for the hotel,
yes,
and the paid for the food.
Yes.
Did you also pay some for the air transportation, some airfare?
Yes, we used to give them some support. The UN also, at one point, also had to get some monies for this, because we sort of got fed up with the fact that we were only paying the debt, and the fact that we had to pay for sometimes even authorities from El Salvador ask us for air tickets from El Salvador to Mexico, and we thought it was very useful, and obviously Mexico was playing a role, and we had to pay for that, you know, and this is and it was difficult for the Salvadorians to move to another country, first of all because we are the closest country to El Salvador of the four friends, and they couldn't really go to the United States until we reached the stage where they went to the UN, and then
they didn't have visas to get in.
Yes, we had a lot of problems for them to get the visa, because there are certain provisions in the INS that do not allow people who have been, let's say, engaged in armed struggles that perhaps had killed U.S. citizens. And some of them were sort of involved in that type of characterization, so it was very difficult to get them. I think Pickering, again, the plus one was very important, because we need to have certain actors sitting in New York, and so they had to go to very painful discussions in Washington, trying to convince the right people that it was key that these people will have to come to New York. And they came every time with a lot of restrictions. They couldn't really move from one street to another. I mean, they had a limit of streets they could go. And so mainly it was in the surroundings of the UN. So sometimes that we sort of met, in, for instance, in the residence of the Mexican representatives that is in 72nd Street, they were out of limits. And so they were smuggling by our friends, you know, and so they were against the law when every time that we had meetings at the residence, because we were in 72nd, and they were not allowed to move from 47 to 52 from the UN area, and they couldn't go better than Third Avenue either, you know. So I mean, that was that was ridiculous, but it was very important, and that was the only way to get the famous waiver for them to go into New York, you know.
Oh, I see.
So going back to the discussions in Mexico that we had almost everywhere, in different hotels in Mexico City, different hotels outside Mexico City, in Morelos and Tlaxcala and so on and so forth. And as I said, you know, we had the problem that they couldn't really stand each other. We had to keep them separate, and it was Alvaro who was moving from one room to the other, at least until the last part of the negotiation, you know. Even the last day, we had this particular problem because we couldn't get together the two delegations, and so we had to separate them in different floors at the UN.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say that part was very important, but as what I was discussing is why Mexico had such a leverage once again, because the President Salinas, Secretary Solana, were very much engaged into this, and again, we had no choice. If we wanted to have peace, the FMLN and the FDR didn't accept to move to any other place.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And that's the reason why it was the two sides who decided that the signature of the peace process was going to take place in Mexico.
Right.
It was a recognition of the fact that for a decade and a little bit more of that, everything happened in Mexico.
Absolutely. I wanted to just ask you though, on the USSR and Cuba, did they agree though to not obstruct the process?
Yes, we're talking about a different Cuba and USSR to the one that we discussed before. You know, we're talking about the USSR at the end of the Cold War.
Right.
We're talking about 1990, 1991.
Yeah.
The USSR was in the process almost of disintegration.
Right.
In fact, during the last days of Mr. Perez de Cuellar, I recall that we had a meeting on the 24th of December, and we had a meeting in his own residence. He was suffering from some back pains or some problems with his leg or something. So we met there, the four friends, and he received there the confirmation that from Gorbachev that the, for all practical purposes, the USSR was going to be dismantled at the end of the year, and Russia was going to take the seat of the Permanent Security Council. So it was, we sort of received directly from Javier Pérez de Cuellar right away the news that Soviet Union was not going to, no longer the Soviet Union, from a week from then, from the Christmas Eve, you know. And we were discussing with Javier until late at night, and next day, the 25th of December, we were in the middle of a very complicated negotiations. In fact, my family is still sort of recalling that I didn't have Christmas and I didn't have New Year's Eve. And on the 25th of December, I'm going to be very open with this. I sort of brought into my residence and to the Mexican residence, three members of the FMLN and two members of the U.S. delegation. And we were discussing, I mean, some wording, and we were discussing some kind of things that, and as I said, I am not authorized to say what members of the U.S. delegation, but I can say that we all were aware that we were doing something illegal in terms of, but it was illegal, something illegal in with the purpose of achieving peace, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Nobody was in my residence. My family was already in Mexico, and so we kept working for almost 8 hours. And three of the most important, at least two of the most important commanders of the guerrilla, were sitting there for the first time, eye to eye with the U.S. And that mm-hmm. Christmas Day was extremely important.
Mm-hmm.
Once, if I see the others disclose their names, I will certainly recognize whether it's true or not, but that Christmas Day was critical for us to sort of move ahead once that without intermediaries, the U.S. and the guerrillas, you know. I can assure you that Joaquin Villalobos was there, mm-hmm. and at that time Joaquin was the head of the leading military force in El Salvador on the guerrillas, mm. and it was Joaquin who had obviously the power to decide certain things. And then we all discussed the day after with the Salvadorian delegation, the governmental delegation, you know, some of the achievements that we sort of reached that day on Christmas Day. You know? So I guess that critical, that week was so critical in terms of what the friends of the Secretary General could do. We had meetings almost 10, 12 hours, 14 hours in the Mexican mission with both sides, and then we move into the UN, back into the mission, and so it was the headquarters right. for a practical purpose of this. At one different points, and my colleagues from Venezuela, El Salvador, Venezuela, Colombia, and Spain will definitely tell you this. In fact, Ambassador Cepeda from Colombia was here about a couple of weeks ago, and he made a public speech and sort of recalled the day that we thought that everything was going to fail, and I suggest that we should go to see the Secretary General. The all three were sort of very reluctant, saying, "But we don't have an appointment." I said,
"Okay, I wanted to talk about this because actually Bernard Aronson and a few other people had told me about this, and one of the things I wanted to ask."
Who told you that?
Bernard Aronson.
Bernard Aronson.
Yeah. and the Venezuelan ambassador.
Aria.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Right. So now, what day was this that you went?
Well, I think that I would have to go into my diary.
It was the end of December.
I don't know if it was the end of December. It was, let's say, 3 days. I would say probably 28, 29
okay.
of December.
Okay.
That
we
knew that that this was going to exploit, and I said we have to go immediately. Mm-hmm. And my three friends decided that. We had to sort of get the appointment, be proper, and so on and so forth. And I said, well, like in the days when I was student leader, I mean, let's go, and we have to open that door, you know, even if the policeman doesn't allow us. I mean, we have to get there because, and yes, I said, I use that expression. We have, if it's necessary, we kick the door. But I use that expression. It's true. They say that is true. I said, we kick the door, and...
I believe that Ambassador Aria said that.
I said, but Jorge is impossible. Yes, we have to move that way. Teres de Cuellar would not play a role unless we tell, explain him, you know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Was not a good chemistry between some of my friends with Alvaro Soto. I was the one who kept until the very last day, and still today remains today, a very close communication with Alvaro. I think that was very unfair that they were considering Alvaro guilty of something, you know, and inclined to one side or the other. And I was always on his side, you know, because I thought, not because Alvaro was friend or anything, because I thought that the UN, if the UN didn't have our support, then the whole process was going to collapse.
Right.
So we went into the Secretary General, and obviously
okay, so it was you, and was Aria with you?
Yes, no, I had it before. I had my car, and I said, let's go. Yeah.
Okay, so you had...
I was driving the car, and I said, let's go to the Secretary General's office.
Okay, so you had the four ambassadors with you.
Yes.
And then when you got into his office, was Alvaro and Goulding there? Was Mark Goulding there?
It was, exactly, yes.
Yeah, okay.
And obviously, Perez de Cuellar was shocked about the fact that... First of all, the guard told us, you know, I'm sorry, Mr. Ambassador, but you don't have the appointment. I said, he's without appointment. And when the guard went into the corridor, and I said, let's go, move to the next stage, you know, to the next station, and we move to the next. What are you doing here, Mr. Ambassador? We are here. Tell him that we are outside, though.
Yeah.
We need to see him right
now. Yeah.
The other three were, let's say, less audacious.
because
yeah, yeah, yeah.
They were very, very upset about it. So Jorge, what's going to happen? I said, unless he opens the door right now, I'm going to get into that office.
Right.
And I was decided. I was decided because I thought that that was the only way to sort of break and that standstill, and we needed, and obviously it was a misunderstanding as well involving the UN. And fortunately, Javier opened the door and said, well, what's going on? And I said, we're very sorry. I was spokesperson. I'm very sorry, but we need you to get involved in this. This is a very serious matter. You have less than 72 hours as Secretary General.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was using the language like, well, I'm going into vacation to holiday on day after tomorrow. And I'm very sorry, guys. And I said, listen, Mr. Secretary General, I'm not going to talk to my friend. Mr. Secretary General, you have a responsibility. And if you don't assume that responsibility, we're going to have a press conference. And we're going to say that the UN Secretary General do not want to participate in this. Yes, I was using a very tough language.
Yeah, yeah.
But the reason why I was using that tough language is because we spoke with both sides, with the government and with the guerrillas. And we knew that it was the only leverage of the Secretary General that could sort of put the things together.
Yeah.
And Javier was tired, was ill. As I mentioned to you, he had these back pains, had problems with the leg, and he was in the last, really, the aftermath of his 10 years at the UN.
Mm-hmm.
He was, I would say, fed up.
Yeah.
And
his wife had reservations.
No, but that was on the 31st. No, that was on the 31st. That was a different occasion.
Yeah.
No, I'm talking about, no, this is the 29th.
Oh, okay, 20th. Okay.
And I said, well, I mean, you are fed up, you are tired, but we need you.
Mm-hmm.
And you better get back into the arena. And, or we're going to say that to the world, you know, that we are almost there. And he told us, you know, but don't make so much fuss. On the 2nd of January, you have a new secretary, you know, fresh, and prepare for this. You've been already discussing this with Boutros Ghali. He's fully aware of this thing. He's already there at the UN Plaza. Go and see him. I said, listen, we're not playing games. We're convinced. By the way, I informed immediately to Bernie Aronson, Washington. I said, Bernie, we are in our way to see the Secretary General. We need your full support. If Perez de Cuellar do not accept this, we are going to have a press conference. We need the press conference 4+1. And he said, okay, that's fine. Let's do that. He was in Washington. I called him from my car. And as I said, you know, I didn't have the full support of the other friends who were worried about the fact we are not planning potential, you know. I mean,
mm-hmm.
What your president is going to say, you know. Mm-hmm. How come you went into the office of the Secretary General? But I thought it was necessary, you know, and we didn't have time to get instructions. That was the point of some of my friends. Instructions on the 29th of December when your president might be in the beach, might be with the family.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, that's for me, there's no choice, you know. So we better move there. Fortunately, after a very kind of sour meeting with Javier, he decided to sort of move ahead. He sort of started again the diplomacy with both sides, and sort of we got out of that stalemate, you know, a standstill where we were. And
now,
then,
can I ask you a question about that meeting again? Because my understanding, and you can correct me, is that Alvaro de Soto was not as worried about Perez de Cuellar becoming involved in the process.
Yes, that's a good.
And then Marat Guli was more supportive of what you were trying to do.
Yes, I think that was, in a way, that was the only part that, from my point of view, I share some concerns of my friends. I think that Alvaro is correct. Alvaro didn't want the Secretary General to play a role because Alvaro wanted to play the role. I mean, this is a kind of very human attitude, but in a way it was a selfish attitude. Because Alvaro didn't have any longer the leverage to do so. You know.
Mm-hmm.
That was exactly my point when both sides had sort of
lose faith on Alvaro and the Argos team, you know. Mm-hmm. So that's why I said, unless you move, neither De Soto, neither Ruben can do anything. It's you. I mean, we are convinced of this. We spoke with both sides. Both sides are, for one reason or another, and forgive me for this, Alvaro, but for one reason or another, both sides are very, very skeptical about your team. I know that once you move this thing, Alvaro will recover this. And
yeah,
Alvaro,
yeah.
Alvaro was, yes, it's true, Alvaro was reluctant, and I would say that he put it very intelligently in saying, you know, I don't want Secretary General to get tainted by this thing, you know. Mm-hmm. Both sides are tired, mm-hmm. fatigue is there, so,
yeah.
And I said, no, I have the assurance, you know. Mm-hmm. And they sort of made a commitment. We are here because we spoke with both sides a lot. But they don't want to break this thing with you. They want to have the conversation directly with Secretary General. It's true, Goulden was more careful as a good Englishman, you know, but he was kind of saying, I think the ambassadors are correct. I think Alvaro and I, we are in a way already overruled by both sides, and this is something that needs your clout, your leverage, your authority, you know,
mm-hmm.
and it's true. And
okay.
So again, so the process was restarted. At one point, we were sort of threatened by one side of, we're going to leave Washington, we're going to leave New York, we're leaving tomorrow, and this was very funny. We didn't discuss the previous process of negotiation that we had in September, when Cristiani spent there about 10 days in New York, when we mm-hmm. sort of had the first agreements that with the ones we were working from September to December.
Mm-hmm.
The ones in September were very critical, very important, and Cristiani didn't have transportation, and we lent him in one of the Pemex aircrafts to go to New York.
Mm.
And apparently, because the negotiation was going to last only about 24 hours,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the negotiation lasted about 9 or 10 days, and the plane was there.
Mm.
And I had all kind of pressures from people in Pemex saying, we need the plane, you know. No, you cannot take the plane because Cristiani can fly back today, you know. Cristiani was saying, please, as the President Salinas, I want to keep, because otherwise the media in Salvador will kill me if they know that I don't have any longer the plane, and I'm not, because he was always playing with his own media saying, if I don't have a response about this particular point today,
mm-hmm.
I'm going to get back. I'm going to break the negotiation.
Oh, I see.
You know?
So he had the plane waiting.
So the plane there was very important as a symbol that he was really almost about to break a deal, and so that's why it was kind of a signal for his own gatherers, you know.
Right.
And I haven't said a word, and it would be an omission on my side not to say anything about Mrs. Cristiani. Cristiani played, from my point of view, one of the most important roles in this peace process. A quiet, silent woman who was always there with a laptop near President Cristiani, and when we had difficult moments, Cristiani used to look at Margarita, wife, and without really saying anything, Margarita just say yes or not with the eyes, you know. And we knew very well that the lady was tremendous force there, and as I said, she was always with the laptop, taking notes and so on and so forth. But we had very complicated moments and different wordings or approach to the various aspects, and Cristiani always relied on the good judgment of his wife. And I think it's very important to say that because without her, I think that this process would not really reach the levels that we reach, you know. And I guess that that recognition is important. You know?
And finally, at the end of the of this process, on the probably what Bernie mentioned to you was the another complicated moment, that's the 31st, that we started very early discussing the various aspects that were sort of missing, mainly the agrarian reform one was one that was very critical. And from the government, the negotiator was the then mayor of El Salvador, that then became president of El Salvador, Calderón Sol.
He was there.
He was there as negotiator of this particular part. And in the guerrilla side was Handal, Chafik Handal, the one who was. And they hate each other. I mean, it was mainly a problem of chemistry, you know. Again, people were tired. It was 31st of December, and last day, and so on and so forth. And it was a very complicated day. Adamson was there in New York, and we were sort of kept very close together, the 4+1. Again, Perez de Cuellar said at about 5 o'clock, okay guys, I'm sorry, I'm leaving. He called us to our missions. And again, we said, no, we're going immediately to the UN. And we called Aronson and Pickering. And we moved into the UN. It was around 4, 5:30, 6 o'clock. I met Mrs. Perez de Cuellar in the corridor. She hated me in her eyes, you know. Javier was very pale, was clearly in pain. And we sat at the map room, and I said, I was the spokesperson again, and I said, Mr. Secretary General, we understand that you want to leave. And he said, no, I don't want to leave, I'm going to leave. And I said, well, I have the support of the four friends in the United States to say that we don't want to leave. We are sure that in the next 6 hours we're going to compete. I'm not going to play games about moving the clock and all these things. It's midnight. But then he said, you know, I'm sorry, I have a plane already waiting for me. I'm going to Bahamas. The plane is leaving at 7 o'clock. Bernie Adamson sent me a note. You know, you think that I can ask the Federal Aviation to stop the plane?
So, Bernie sent you that note?
You see, and I said, you can say that to him. And I said,
that's great.
Mr. Secretary General, give us half an hour. We go downstairs. We can speak with both sides, and we can give you, and then we bring you assurances that people are prepared to break a deal tonight.
Okay. And so now, I just want to get the logistics correct.
Yes.
Because now the FMLN were more or less meeting in one set of rooms. Where were they?
They were, at that point, we didn't have time for the game that I'm not going to see each other, you know, so they.
Yeah.
From the 29, they started to get together. Not with President Cristiani. But yes, with the other members of the delegation.
The delegation.
You know,
yeah,
it's in that picture, you know. And,
yes.
No, it was Cristiani was kept in one place, so Cristiani couldn't really meet.
He was in the UN, but he was in a different office.
Yes, office and different floor as well.
Oh, okay.
And we had the 38 and 37 floors, people on both sides of the elevators, you know, working in the different issues.
Okay.
And so that's why the logistics were very close, you know. I mean, you have only to go downstairs, one floor or two flights, you know, and that you were there with the actors. And
okay,
guys, we had 30 minutes to go back with the Secretary General. The Secretary General wants to leave. And unless you so decide to be serious and to accept that we can take back guarantees, and the 4+1 will be there, back with Perez de Cuellar, and that's the only reason why Perez de Cuellar will accept to stay in New York. Otherwise, he will catch a private plane at 7 o'clock. So it's up to you. It's your country that's in the middle of this thing.
Yeah.
And I said, I can assure you that, I remember perfectly well, I said, I can assure you that the new Secretary General, even if it's good faith, the new Secretary General would like to reopen everything.
Yeah.
I didn't have the structure to say that, but and I didn't have any grounds. I mean, that I was really clearly, you know, lying to them, you know. But you need that, you know. At one point, I said, "Well, I have to use whatever excuse." And I received immediately a note from one of my friends saying, "Who told you Boutros Ghali's to change anything?" And everything I said, nobody.
Nobody. Right.
Nobody. And it was
a believable thing to say.
It was believable. Yeah. I mean, you would have new people there.
Yeah.
Probably the soccer would not be there. Mark, Uli would not be there, and so on and so forth.
Mm.
And I said, it's one, either you take it or leave. And since you can all, I mean, you could communicate with them in Spanish, was even better, because you have emphasis in your own language, and it's very important. I said, I use some strong language as well, not necessarily nice words. And I said, it's either you decide whether you want to rescue your country today, or you want this to collapse.
Mm-hmm.
When we are discussing just minor words, and you have people dying, or have been dying for almost 20 years, and so I don't understand how come you are playing like kids.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry to speak that way to ministers and whatever. Probably tomorrow your president can ask my president to remove me. But now, as a friend of the Secretary General, I have to say that if Pérez Recuella is going to remain, it's for something consistent and serious.
Yeah.
Not for
children's
games, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And if we have their guarantees, we go back to the 38th floor to speak to Pérez Recuella to give them guarantees.
Okay.
So they discussed among themselves, and I said, 10 minutes. Because I said, in 3 minutes, we have to be back.
Yeah.
And we have to be serious. 10 minutes, we convene again. And Arafat said, you know, Jorge, you get everything. I said, yes. Everything's on the table.
Yeah.
And they probably say they don't care.
Yeah.
They probably would like to go and have a few drinks. It's New Year's Eve. And that's it, you know. My family is in Acapulco. What do you want me to do? You know, perhaps you can buy me to have a drink with you, but what we can do?
Yeah.
Nothing to do. So after 10 minutes, both sides, you know, came like this. So, yes, we accept.
Mm-hmm.
And we're prepared to
work
like that until we finish and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
We need you to help us to break a deal in this part. There were only three or four issues, important ones, but they had to be aware that we were not really playing games. And you know that it's very often in this type of negotiations you set a time limit, and then you sort of in diplomacy you call sort of slowing the clock or putting the clock ahead, depending what you need.
Yeah.
You said we're not going to play with the clock. 10 o'clock, at 12 o'clock, at the latest 12 o'clock, in 1 minute Pérez Recuella is leaving this building. Forever. This is for sure. So
that's right.
It's up to you to decide what you want. So, okay, we went back into Pérez Recuella's office, into the map room. He thought that we were going to fail. This is purely the work of the 4+1. And this is not the work of the UN. The UN was already out of the picture for the two parties. It was. That's why I think it's fair to say that the UN, the US played a very important role. You know, it was without the 4+1. And that's why I disagreed completely with the account that Pérez Recuella gives in that chapter of his book. You know, because it's very unfair. Yeah. When you had at one point Bush calling Cristiani, Bush or Baker doing things personally in these type of things, or President Salinas and so on and so forth, and to rely on your own judgment saying it was the work of this thing. Yeah, the team was very useful, and the team put together everything and so on and so forth, but the political leverage,
of the
4+1, mainly of this, I would say, Mexico, the United States and Spain,
but in Mexico, the United States, you know, mm-hmm. I think without that, you know, so that's why at that point they relied on us, you know, mm-hmm. on the representatives of the government, not on the bureaucracy.
Yeah.
It was for them that somebody from Spain, somebody from Mexico, somebody from these two countries are very important, Spain and Mexico, close the United States.
Yeah.
Say Venezuela was already in trouble. Carlos Andrés Pérez had already the first attempt of the coup d'etat of Mr. Chavez.
He had domestic problems.
A lot of domestic problems. Venezuela was very reluctant. I'm sorry, Colombia was very reluctant always to be very active. Why? Because they had their own guerrillas. So, in a way, when Gaviria came into office, said, oh my God, but why are we involved in this, you know, mm-hmm. when we have such a mess in our house, you know? Mm-hmm. So, Colombia was always very, I would say, inactive. Mm-hmm. Venezuela was more active because Arria was active. Mm-hmm. Arria was very close to Carlos Andrés, but didn't have the leverage like I did of calling my president and my president calling President Bush. Mm-hmm. Or my president called, I didn't have the leverage. It was my president who got the leverage. It was my country who got the leverage, you know.
Yeah.
It was my country, or I could.